Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Anna Quinlan's trademark wisdom on family, friendship, and the ties that bind us are at the center of her new novel, After Annie, about the power of love to transcend loss and triumph over adversity. When Annie Brown dies suddenly, her husband, her children, and her closest friend are left to find a way forward without the woman who has been the linchpin of all of their lives. Over the course of the next year, what saves them all is Annie, ever present in their minds, loving but not sentimental, caring but nobody's fool, a voice in their heads that is funny and sharp and remarkably clear. The power she has given to those who loved her is the power to go on without her. Anna Quinlan is a novelist and journalist whose work has appeared on fiction, nonfiction, and self-help bestseller lists. While a columnist at the New York Times, she won the Pulitzer Prize. Her latest is After Annie, and before a full house at the Southern Vermont Art Center in Manchester, Vermont, we welcome Anna Quinlan. How are you?
Good. I'm glad to be back with you. I love doing this event with you.
Well, I love doing it with you. This is really fun. And I love this novel so much. I think the last time we were together, I think, was for a nonfiction book. And this is, I don't think we've talked about, well, we talked about your fiction the last time we spoke, but not in this detail. This is a beautiful, sweet, lovely novel. And I'm very curious. You know, first of all, nice job on killing the character off on the first page.
Wait, the first sentence.
The first sentence.
Yes.
Like that's good. Like, I'm like, wow, that, all right. And that's pretty much the death toll of the novel.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the most important thing about the novel is it's not really after Annie. I mean, Annie's the most vivid character in the whole book. And that was a point I wanted to make, which is I think that most of us, when someone we love dies, feel them, know them, understand what they've brought to us more vividly than when they were alive, which in a way is a great tragedy. I mean, when the people we love are around us, it's sort of like, oh, okay, she's in the kitchen. Okay, he's in the den. It's only when they're gone that you think, no, not the kitchen, not the den, in my heart, in my mind, in every bit of myself. And that's the thing with these characters in After Annie, that Annie lives so vividly in them that even though she dies in the first sentence, as we said, she really is the most alive person in the book.
She leaves a husband, four children, her best friend. These are the characters that we meet and we get to know the best. There is her mother-in-law.
Now, I mean, I didn't mean to stereotype, but here's the thing. I'm a big lover of Dickens. I reread Dickens all the time, had a profound effect on me. And one of the things that I learned so indelibly from Dickens is that your central characters are important and fully fledged and so on and so forth, but your secondaries are where the fun is.
That's right.
So we don't remember David Copperfield as much as we remember Uriah Heep, you know? and you know, A Christmas Carol, everybody remembers Scrooge, but in my family, we really remember Fezziwig.
Oh, sure.
Dancing with Mrs. Fezziwig. Bill Brown's mother, Dora, is a secondary character, and she's this close to being a caricature. But man, she was so much fun in her terribleness.
Everyone is so supportive in this novel. There is such support of each other as they're getting through this grief. And she's like the one person who doesn't really get it.
Yeah, but also, don't you think most of us have at least one person in our life, hopefully somewhat peripherally, who's really negative?
Oh, sure.
Who always sees a glass half empty, who always says, you know, not that. And she's the person in this household. And of course, she's not just there for show. One of the reasons that Bill Brown loves his wife so much and is so happy in this little average life they've built together is because this is the first person who's really made him feel fully loved and supported and important. And that, of course, that wasn't what his mother did, but it sure is what Annie does for him.
She really filled a void that he had.
Exactly.
In his life.
Exactly.
And that is brought out in the novel in several ways, but also in his relationship also with his children.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to stereotype all men, but what he discovers...
Oh, go ahead.
I mean, what he discovers when his young... I mean, they're both in their mid-30s. His young wife suddenly dies, is that he's had this life, and his wife has basically engineered 90% of it. That, you know, whether there's food in the fridge, whether the kids have new shoes, whether anybody realizes the kids need new shoes, all of that has been totally Annie's purview, and he hasn't really focused on that in his life until the day when he wakes up in the morning and realizes he has no clue how to hold this life together.
Here's what he thought. Lying in bed that night, staring at the popcorn ceiling with moonlight raking in as though it were trying to make it less ugly. All the general things people said about how the person was a good friend and a good wife and a good mother were useless, almost insulting in their lack of specificity. But all the specific things he could say about Annie, the girl he'd picked up at the party, picked up and knocked up, married, made a life with, were too intimate. It wasn't just that Bill was uncomfortable standing up and speaking in front of a lot of people. It was that what he had, he didn't want to share. He needed to hold it all now like a life preserver. It's a beautiful, beautiful
thank you.
But that also shows his thoughtfulness. This is a nice guy.
Oh, really nice guy. I mean, people ask me all the time about that fact that he can't really deal in the beginning, that Allie, who is 13 years old, is in some sense left to become an adult, to pick up the pieces. As though it shows that he has serious shortcomings. He doesn't. He's just, you know, we sort of seg into various aspects of our lives that make a whole, and we don't examine them until we're forced to by illness, by hard times, by death. And he's had an unexamined life because it's been such a good life and because he is such a good guy.
The novel is segmented by season from winter to winter. It's a beautiful, for want of a better term, device to bring us through the year of grief. Did that come early, that was how you were going to go at it?
I think it was the other way around, Joe, in that I was going at it and suddenly I realized that the seasons, that the description of the weather outside and the clothes they were wearing and how the yard looked, that it's sort of naturally divided into those seasonal aspects.
Almost the feelings in the novel are representative of those seasons, of how we sort of think of those seasons, right?
Yeah, and how, you know, the earth is very hard and frozen and cold, and it begins to soften up just a little bit as spring turns to summer.
I wanted to read, there's one of my favorite sections in the book, because you were mentioning winter and clothing. This is the youngest. The bread had those tiny sesame seeds along the crust, and he had watched dead-eyed as Benji insisted on picking them all out, even once there was syrup, so that there was syrup under his fingernails and later lint from his gloves on his fingertips because of it. Then he sucked on his fingers and had gotten the lint in his mouth so that all during dinner time he was picking red fuzz off of his tongue. That's great.
There are a few things that I know a lot about, but one of the few is raising young children.
and the fuzzy, sticky stuff, right? So there's the seasons, and then there are these characters as they move through and how they relate to one another. But also, you give each of them their moment to figure this out, to look at where they are and to assess what they had, what they have, perhaps what they can have in the future.
Well, and one of the things that was really interesting to me when I was doing this is, so one of them's a 13-year-old girl, one of them is Bill, who is a man in his mid-30s, and one is Anne Marie, who has been Annie's best friend since they met in first grade. And after a while, I realized that there was a kind of a Venn diagram, that there were areas about Annie, that there were areas that they remembered about Annie, that there were things Annie had said to each of them that overlapped, but only slightly. And that in that Rashomon way that is so compelling, each of them would remember it somewhat differently, especially between Bill and Anne Marie. I mean, there's a line in there that says something like, "No man ever likes his wife's best friend."
Right.
And I think there's a tension between the two of them, a feeling on Anne Marie's part that she's been supplanted by the pull of Annie's family, a feeling on Bill's part that Annie opened up to Anne Marie about things in a way that she might not do with him. This picture that you get of Annie that after a while, because of these three different voices, becomes truly three-dimensional. And I was really engaged by that, by the ways in which you would get different views of the same event or the same thing from each of these three people.
And the relationship between Bill and Anne Marie is fascinating because there's at one point, and I don't want to give anything away, but Anne Marie is a recovering addict or an addict. Annie was the one who guided her and really the one person that would say no and would go beyond the call of duty. And sometimes Bill would look and say, "What are you doing?"
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah, you're going too far. And there's a sad moment where she actually basically freelance rehabs her best friend in the nursing home where she works and says, "You know, what you're doing is going to kill me." And Anne Marie thinks in retrospect, "But we never thought if it worked the other way around." I mean, Annie's the person who keeps Anne Marie on the straight and narrow, and suddenly she's gone. Well, again, she's not really gone. I mean, every time Anne Marie's in the car, she envisions Annie riding shotgun. Every time she gets ready to do something she shouldn't do, she inevitably hears Annie's voice in her head. Sometimes she ignores it, but she hears it.
Annie Quinlan is our guest on this week's book show, The New Novel After Annie. It is published by Random House. As far as the character of Annie, even though, as we said, this is a character who is remembered throughout the novel, but how did you flesh that character out in the beginning? What did you know everything about her from the start?
Interestingly enough, with this novel, I knew nothing about her except for one thing. Usually, I build a character from the ground up for months before I start working on a novel. I build the central character. I'm walking along the river, and I think of a woman who's a photographer, and she used to be really famous for her pictures, but now, you know, fame doesn't translate into money, and she's running. And the next thing I know, I've got Rebecca Winter renting a cottage in the middle of nowhere to try to become solvent again. But that takes months and months and months of, okay, she was an only child. Oh, okay, this was what her first husband was like, things like that. I do a lot of composition when it looks like I'm power walking. And walking one day and suddenly having this vivid mental picture of this young woman dishing out mashed potatoes and getting a terrible pain in her head and falling to the floor of her shabby kitchen and the wooden spoon she was using sort of skittering across the floor and leaving a little trail of mashed potatoes. And I mean, it really almost came out of nowhere. And I thought, that's the beginning of this book. And so in an odd kind of way, I fleshed out Annie as they were remembering her, that things would come into Allie's mind about her mother, and I'd think, oh, yeah, Annie's like that, you know? Mm-hmm. It was the least knowledgeable I've been about a central character starting a novel than I've ever been before, and this is my 10th novel.
But it also says a lot about the process of grief, where there's obviously the devastating loss, but there's also the good stuff. We relate to what we miss or the things that we had that are special and amazing, which is a long way of saying that Annie comes off as quite an angel in this, really.
Well, but the danger with grief, I think, and with death, is that you only remember the good stuff. So
right.
That over the years, I mean, it's been 52 years since my own mother died. And it has occurred to me more than once over those years that we turned her into a kind of a plaster saint that doesn't really have any oomph to her. And of course, since I was so young when she died, I sort of don't really know how to work around that. And most of the people who knew her now are dead as well, my father and her best friend and so on and so forth. And one of the things I like about the portrayal of Annie is that there's this underlying toughness that they remember too, that Anne Marie certainly remembers from Annie saying to her,
"The stern.
You can either clean up your act or you're not going to be my friend anymore." Some of the times when she really pushed Bill to do or behave in certain ways. So I like that about her, that she, as you said in your introduction, she's nobody's fool. You know, she's somebody who, at the same time that, again, she's a really good person. I mean, there's the scene in the book that probably came closest to writing itself, and believe me, none of it comes close to writing itself. I find it all really excruciating to do. But there's a scene where the whole family goes to the nursing home where Annie was an aide because they're planting a tree in her memory. And all these people in wheelchairs have over their legs afghans, which Annie made because that's one of the things that she does. And that sense that these people really felt cared for by their paid caregiver, I think says something about her that's so important and so powerful.
Why do you think that particular section wrote itself?
It was very visual, but also I had this profound, people keep quoting back to me one line in there, which really has nothing to do with Annie, or maybe obliquely it does, a woman who's there who was once a concert pianist with the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra says to Allie, "All of us here, we were someone else once." Hmm. And I think people really feel that powerfully about getting older, that there's that sense that they were somebody and maybe not so much anymore. I really felt this powerful affinity to these people who had relied on this young woman as they were themselves approaching death at their age, and yet things had turned out so differently.
Let's talk about Allie. Allie is the daughter, 13 years old, and has a lot on her plate, especially after the death of her mother, but is trying to keep the trains running on time.
Well, yeah, I mean, even when you're only 13, when you have three younger brothers and you look in the refrigerator and there's no milk, you know you got a problem. And
yeah,
it's a problem that you can't wait around to solve. So she obviously can't do what her mother did. She's in school. She's only 13. Her brother, who is closest in age to her aunt, keeps pushing back against her. You know, the classic, "You're not the boss of me" situation. But she just keeps trying to fill in the holes oh my God, you know, there's no clean clothes, so maybe I better put a load in the wash. How do I do that again? You know, there isn't any milk. I better get somebody, she gets Anne Marie, to take her to the supermarket. All that kind of stuff. And you can figure that at a certain point she's going to blow at her father in one way or another. And in fact, that is later on in the book what happens. But by that time, Bill has begun to realize that he needs to step up more.
I think you handle it beautifully of counseling, the therapy, the guidance that Allie gets in school, and that character and the very careful relationship the two of them have that spider webs to the other characters as well.
The best characters in all my novels are always people in the helping professions. They're always either teachers or nurses or social workers. And in this case, there's a school counselor. Allie really doesn't want to go because there's this kind of onus in school. Everybody, if you get sent to the counselor, everybody either figures you're starving yourself or cutting, as she tells the counselor. But the counselor is really, really helpful to her, at least in letting her vent. You know, part of the problem with grief is people don't really want you to talk about it. You get the statutory sort of 5 days during which everybody talks about, you know, how wonderful the person was and how much everybody's going to miss them. And from that point on, most of the peripheral people in your life wait for you to get over it, to achieve closure, to move on. And it's this completely phony setup, as though one day you're going to wake up and go, well, you know, my mother died, no biggie, you know, as opposed to, I think what people don't make is a distinction between two things. Grief. Grief has claws. Grief has teeth. Grief is like a razor blade. But what comes after grief is loss. And loss is like a well where if you toss a stone in, you never hear the plop. Yeah. And that's the thing that all of these people begin to realize, that after the grief comes the loss, and they've just got to find a way to live with the fact that this is it forever, really.
The novel is beautiful. You get a sense. It's a very satisfying ending, I'll put it that way. There's just a beauty to it, and you have a sense of, okay, well, we'll be all right. And that's, I assume, what you wanted.
Life will go on for all these people. It has to go on for all these people. It inevitably goes on for a teenage girl. But for Anne Marie, she's found a new way of living. And for Bill, he's working it through. So, yeah, I do think that there's that sense. I don't want to communicate that loss is so overwhelming that there's no good side to this. I mean, I remember reading an interview with the actress Laura Linney where she was talking about her friend Natasha Richardson, who died in a terrible accident, and she talked about the privilege of living, the privilege of aging. And you know, I think that's one of the things that you take away when you've loved somebody very much who dies, that you wish they had had that privilege. And given the fact that they didn't, you damn well better take it seriously and do the best you can with what you got.
Of the story, as you say, and the writing can be excruciating. How does that work when you write humor? There's some beautiful sections that are just so funny. I've heard it described by some authors that it's the hardest thing to write because once you edit it, you're screwing around with it, and then it's, you know, after the 20th revision, it's not funny anymore. But is that a relatively easy process?
Nothing about writing is easy for me.
Yeah.
I find it very, very hard, and I think the main reason that it's hard is because it's an exercise in confidence. I mean, every time you sit down, there's got to be a voice inside you that says, I have something important to say. And that's a really hard thing to bring to the table all the time. And, I work in two different rooms that are lined with books. So if I want to, you know, if I want to feel humble, all I need to do is swivel the chair around and look at my full collection of Dickens' work, or look at all the Jane Austen I have, or with contemporaries, look at all of my Alice McDermott novels or my Amy Bloom novels. So it's intimidating, and you have to bring the confidence. And to the extent that there's humor in this book, it's not my humor; it's in the characters.
Sure.
I'm a very character-driven novelist. I remember handing in the manuscript of my first novel, Object Lessons, and my editor, who is still my editor, Kate Medina at Random House, said to me, you know, this is really beautifully written, and the characters are so resonant, but nothing really happens. And I said to her, that's just like real life. And she looked down at the pages and said, and that's why we call this a novel. And what I eventually learned is that you could still be character-driven. And I mean, this book is utterly character-driven. But if you put characters together at a certain moment in their lives, then what they do to and with one another becomes plot. Plot is essentially uninteresting to me. I mean, every time you try to, someone says, well, what's this novel about? And I want to say, well, what's Anna Karenina about? She's married, she has a kid, she falls in love with somebody else, she throws herself under a train, end of discussion. No, that is not what Anna Karenina is about. So I'm very character driven. I don't really care about plot, but I've learned to live with it. But I still feel every day as though I'm saying to myself, can you manage this? And professionally, that's a hard thing to do, to say every day, can you manage this?
The novel is absolutely beautiful. It is After Annie. It is published by Random House. Anna Quinlan, what a absolute delight to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
We always have a good time talking together.
Again, Anna Quinlan's new novel is After Annie. It is published by Random House. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. This program was recorded before a live audience at the Southern Vermont Arts Center and a Northshire Bookstore event, Northshire.com. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.